This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So next we're going to move to prevention of cardiovascular disease and focus primarily on lipid management as our strategy to do that. I speak on this topic with some humility, knowing that you've thought about this quite a bit. You do this every day in practice. And there are some areas of continued practice from what you've been doing. I'll try to emphasize best practices and a few pearls as we go through that section. There is some new information that I hope is practice changing that we'll do in the middle of the talk. And then I'll say a few words of what we can expect in the future as well. I have no financial relationships. So what we're doing with lipid management is working. Since 1950, the death rates from cardiovascular disease have decreased significantly, about 60%. In the last 20 years, there's been a little bit more fluctuation. There was actually a small decrease between 2010 and 2020. And a slight, actually, a stabilization and increase during the pandemic. But in general, clearly things are going in the right direction. And when people try to model and analyze what the most recent, impactful cause of the decrease is, about half of it's from inpatient care. So the acute treatments that your colleagues do in the CCUs and neuro ICUs and so on. And then half from what we do with risk factor modification. And on the risk factor modification, it's mostly a tie between blood pressure control, lipid control, and smoking cessation. So we're doing great. Keep up the good work. Don't develop clinical inertia here. Statins work, and we'll go through the controversies in the next half hour. So here's a question. This is more just to see what your thoughts are in clinical practice. I'll come back to this towards the end. This is a 65-year-old woman. Her LDL cholesterol is 135. She doesn't have coronary artery disease or other cerebrovascular disease, nor does she have diabetes. She follows all of your lifestyle recommendations. At what 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk would you usually recommend a statin? Okay, excellent. So pretty much on target, as you'll see as we go through some of the different guidelines. The plurality wants to start at 7.5%, and close second is 10%. You'll see those numbers resonate with the guidelines as we go through them. There are a few cardiologists in the room. And a few nihilists as well. So we'll go through the different options together. So just some old data, just to make sure we're all using the language in the same way. I say to patients all the time, the reason we want to take this medication, if it's indicated for you and you choose to take it, is because we will lower your risk of a heart attack or a stroke by a third, by a quarter or a third. And this is the first six studies that showed that, but there are now two dozen of them, and they all show about the same thing. This is events, not mortality, but you can prevent events in men and women based on a quarter or a third reduction. The problem is, and some of you may have heard me say this before, whenever you hear someone say, this treatment lowers your risk of something happening by a quarter or a third, your immediate next response must be a quarter or a third of what? All right? And that's the key difference between relative risk reduction and absolute risk reduction. In other words, if your risk of something happening is really small and you lower that by a quarter or a third, you haven't done much. If your risk of something is high and you lower that by a quarter or a third, you've done something. So that is the whole essence of clinical management of lipid disorders in clinical practice. And we'll address that in several different, from several different perspectives as we go through the talk. So much of the controversies related to this clinical dilemma is, how do you decide what is the risk threshold at which we want to begin treatment? We know it works in everyone. It just doesn't matter very much if your risk is really low. Therefore, the number to treat would be very high. The cost effectiveness would be very high. The balance between good effects and side effects would be unfavorable, and so on. And those are all the kind of conversations you would have with patients. This is another older study to make a very important point, which is a large study, so it allowed us to look at subsets. But basically, the key point was that, again, in this study, statin versus placebo, the drug worked by a quarter. It worked if your LDL was over 130. It worked if your LDL was over 100. But much to everyone's surprise, it also worked if the starting LDL was under 100. So this is where the idea came from, that maybe there's something happening with statins bigger than just LDL reduction. And that's a plaque stability. Frankly, we don't know, but that's why we've seen some tendencies towards further and further aggressive treatment with lipid-modifying drugs in patients at highest risk. And again, we'll come back to that too. So the main guidelines that most of us use are the Heart Association guidelines. These are updated every few years. The most recent iteration was pretty similar to the one before. There are a couple of changes here. This has been around long enough that I won't emphasize the whole history. But this is the current guidelines: a healthy lifestyle for all, four groups of patients who benefit from statins. There's high and moderate intensity statins. We use LDL as our primary treatment. Some patients, if statins don't work, you can use other drugs. And we estimate risk to try to figure out how much, when to start, based upon equations. So that's been around for at least 5 years, and that should be familiar to you. Just a few words of best practices in that context. For lifestyle recommendations, we're talking about diet and exercise, maintaining a desirable body weight, and avoidance of tobacco. We'll say much more about diet and exercise later in the week. For people who have the disease, so if you have clinical atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, that's secondary prevention. That doesn't mean a positive CT scan. And I'll come back to that. This means people with angina, people who have had a stent, people who have had an MI or a stroke and a TAA and so on. But those people we treat very aggressively, and there's tremendous consensus about that in the community. Those with the genetic disorders, which in primary care practice, you can check genetics if you want, but generally people have a family history and their LDL is over 190. People with diabetes. And then the fourth bullet is where the controversies mostly lie, which is so-called primary prevention, people who don't have clinical cardiovascular disease or diabetes or genetic disorder. And the question is, based on their risk, when do you start? This is where the controversy is, this fourth bullet. The first three bullets, I think there's tremendous consensus with some subtlety, some nuance. If you have the disease, we treat aggressively. The data is very clear that if you have an acute MI or an acute stroke and you get 80 milligrams or the equivalent of atorvastatin, you do better. And so patients in primary care often come back to you from the unit after their event on 80. We'll talk about that. There are ways to get around that if people don't like 80, but that's the inpatient recommendation. Conversely, if for some reason that wasn't started in hospital, then you would start a lower dose, but get to 80 quickly, and trying not to have clinical inertia. The goal, we often think of the goal as less than 70. The way that it's written, it's actually less than 50% of your starting LDL. So that's a slight nuance. It gives you some rationale to go a little bit lower than 70, especially in high-risk patients. And some of you may be working with cardiologists who are floating 55 as a number. That mostly comes from European guidelines and some of the experience with some of the newer medicines, which I'll speak about in a moment. And if the patients have very high-risk disease, if they've had a bad MI, multiple vessel disease, a bad stroke, and the like, diabetes, you can use additional medications if you're not under 70 or under 50% of your goal, using ezetimibe or some of the PCSK inhibitors. And I'll say more about those, too. For the genetic disorders, there's a little less long-term data, but nonetheless, we've been doing this for a long time for this cohort. We treat with a high-intensity statin, and again, you can use additional medicines if you're not achieving goals. And diabetes, the current guideline uses the language of moderate intensity statin, but for high intensity if the patient's older. So almost everyone meets that criteria, so everyone gets high intensity there as well. So the bottom line is almost everyone needs to be on, in those first three groups, a high-intensity statin. That's either 40 milligrams of atorvastatin or 80, or the equivalent. For primary prevention, this is where there's controversy, we'll spend more time on this. The key, once again, we come back to shared decision-making, the big challenge of the course, it seems, thus far. And there are different ways to focus this discussion, and I'm going to spend a fair amount of time on this, but talking about explaining risk factors and what's called risk-enhancing factors. So after you estimate patients' risk, there's other things to consider that are not part of our risk equations, and we'll list those in just a moment. We talk obviously about benefits and harms, patient preferences and values. And by the heart association, we would use a starting risk of 7.5% using standard equations, and we would start a moderate intensity statin. Usually start in most people 10 or 20. The key is if you start at 10, don't have clinical inertia, keep going up until you reach your goals. And then we look at risk enhancing factors, which I'll review. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force takes a similar perspective. It's a little more liberal, if you will. They use a 10% as the threshold rather than 7.5%. So it's a little bit softer, but they give a C recommendation to 7.5 as well. C means we don't know for sure. B means you should do it. So 10 is another option, but you can use something lower. Here's my personal perspective on this, and I think the way I think about this, and I actually draw this for patients quite a bit, and that is to say, the relationship between lipids and risk. So if you put cardiovascular disease on the y-axis and lipids on the x-axis, it's a curvilinear relationship. And that is to say two things. Most of the risk is at the high end, and there's not that much difference along the way, and it's continuous. And therefore, our lifelong pattern of arbitrarily creating categories when numbers are continuously related doesn't make a lot of sense. And that's why there's so much controversy. So for an individual patient, the difference between 7.4% and 7.6% is nothing. But we get very categorical when in fact this is a nuanced continuous relationship. And so, patient preference and other factors may be more important than exactly whether you divide the line at 7.5 or 10 or some other number, as I may suggest. All right, this is, I think, where this gets more complicated. So this is now, so what I've said thus far, I think, should be familiar to you for the most part. As is this list, but on this list, there's a lot of meat, even though I'm not going to cover it all, but it should look familiar to you. What this means is that if your equation gives you a number, and then you have some other factors, as shown on this list, the factors move you along to a higher number. Now, the key thing here is that most of these, all of them are important, and it's a long list. Most of them increase your risk by 20%, sometimes 40%, but they don't increase it by 300%. So if your risk of having an MI in the next 10 years is 10%, and you have some of these risk factors, it may go to 12% or 14%. It doesn't go to 30%. You with me? So that's a really important conception, because sometimes people say, oh my God, my LP little a is up. Now that changes everything. Well, not exactly. It increases your risk by 20 to 40%, depending on the level, but it doesn't mean you've gone from no disease to disease. So this is really where the controversy exists, and where there's a difference in practice, I think, between many in the primary care community and many of our specialty colleagues. And so this is an area of controversy. So just to read the list, because they're all important: family history, a notably high LDL, metabolic syndrome, chronic kidney disease, as you'll see in a moment, the metabolic kidney disease aspects of lipid management have been markedly strengthened, and so that becomes more important. Preeclampsia, premature menopause, some of the chronic inflammatory disorders, including HIV and rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis, some high-risk ethnic groups, elevated triglycerides, a mild increase, that's probably the weakest on this list. LP little a, which is sort of the hottest topic, and clearly does increase your risk, although we don't know what to do with it yet. And some of the other biomarkers, ApoB, CRP, and so on. And then coronary artery calcium. So, and you can probably think of a few others, but these are the kind of things that patients are reading about, and you and they need to think about, how does this change my number, and how does this change my decision making? All right, so this is for fun. What risk enhancing factor from that list, from this list that I've summarized from the previous slide, do you use most often to help decide to start a statin? Is it family history, chronic kidney disease, high-risk ethnicity, elevated triglycerides, elevated LP little a or ApoB or CRP, high coronary artery calcium? Any of them would encourage me to start a statin. None, I go by the risk equation only. Interesting, all right. So G, any of them would encourage me to start a statin. Then 20% say family history, and then a smattering of others. LP little a is not the highest. It's down to 3%. And coronary artery calcium also got some response, but not as much as I might have predicted. So this is interesting. This is not exactly what I would have predicted. And the reason is, it doesn't matter, all right? I mean, I think what this reflects is that there's a lot of controversy here, and all of them have an impact on increasing your risk. But I think, again, the take-home message is, how much does it change it? So some of these are going to change it by 20%. So remember, so if your CRP is a little bit elevated, it increases the risk by 20%, and that means you went from 2% risk to 4%, to 2.4% risk. And so if you're a 60-year-old woman with a 2% risk, having a high CRP doesn't change because your number is still really, really small, and you're nowhere near the 7.5%. So be careful with these things. Don't be fooled by them. And I would argue that it's not correct for any of them to encourage you to use a statin. It still makes it a more complex, nuanced conversation about whether to start a statin. But think about that continuous relationship, risk, patient preferences, and the like. There's no right answer here, by the way. Family history, I think, being clinically oriented, you know, if the patient comes in and said, I'm 42 and my dad had a really bad MI at 50, you know, that affects me the most. A family history of premature heart disease, which ironically is not in our risk equations, always is something I take very seriously because it's so embedded in the patient's person, but all of these can increase your risk by some amount. The two that have gotten most of the press of late have been coronary artery calcium and LP little a. And again, let me explain a little bit about at least coronary artery calcium. About a decade ago, the American Radiology Association decided that they were going to make radiologists report coronary artery calcium on every image. And so if you're ordering a CT scan for lung cancer prevention, and then patients over a certain age, there's a very high likelihood that there's going to be coronary artery calcium. And then, of course, we have the more electron beam CT, the rapid CTs, which give you an actual Agatston score, and you can measure exactly how much coronary calcium you have. So there's a lot of this out there in the community. There's some people making a living on this, and a lot of patients are very interested in knowing what their coronary artery calcium score is. I personally don't order a lot of them, but I receive a lot of them, and so it's still necessary to have this conversation. And I think the take-home message is that it's analogous to everything I just said. That is to say, depending on what the results are, it moves you along the spectrum, the continuum, but it doesn't mean you have the disease, except with one exception. So let's go through this a little bit. So the Agatston method is this ECG-gated CT scan. Zero means there's no calcium. 1 through 99 means there's mild. 100 to 399 is moderate, and over 400 is severe. And again, if you do this in enough people who are over a certain age, everyone's going to have some calcium. You can argue in a 35-year-old woman with an LDL that's 195 and no family history, and you're thinking, well, I don't know, does she really need to be on statin for 60 years if you know everyone else in her family doesn't have any disease? This might be a good reason to do a test, right? Because if she has a zero score, you might reassure her and say, all right, maybe you don't need a statin. Let's check that again in 10 years. So there, you can imagine situations. I think of this as a tiebreaker where you might want to do it. So a calcium artery score of zero is a very good negative predictor. Good data to support this, mostly from the MESA study and others. But if you have a zero, there many people could argue you don't need to take a statin, even if your lipids are high. Personally, I would probably still take a statin in that setting, but again, with young people, you would argue against it. Conversely, if the score is very, very high, the 90th percentile or so, over 400, many cardiologists would then consider that secondary prevention, that is a sign of the disease, because your risk of having an event in the future is high. So this is one case where instead of moving along a continuous relationship, you get a sort of a jump up. So if you're in the highest percentile of coronary artery calcium score, maybe then, to me, it's still a risk factor, not a disease, but many in the cardiology community consider a really high score evidence that you have the disease and you should be treated as if you have secondary prevention. Everywhere in between, it's another one of those 20% progressions. That is to say, it's analogous to other risk factors. So if your risk was 10, and your score is, say, 80 on the Agatston scale, it moves from 10 to 12. And there is an equation you can use to figure this out, if you're so inclined, called the MESA equation, and it incorporates this impact. So take-home message, at the extremes, this test is different. Zero means you're at very low risk. Over 400, you're at very high risk. But everywhere else, it just moves you along the continuum. Interestingly, I'm about to show you something new in a minute. In this new process that the Heart Association just developed, they did not integrate coronary artery calcium as a requirement for everyone. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force reviewed this and says there's insufficient evidence for using this on a routine basis. And as I mentioned, the new equation doesn't include it. Nothing new on the medicines, moderate intensity and high intensity. Since rosuvastatin was on patent for a while, most of us started with atorvastatin, and it's easy to use. You start at 10 or 20, it doesn't matter which. I usually start low, go slow, but don't have clinical inertia. Make sure you get up to your goal. The key here, the key message here, is that the dose response curve of these medicines is not linear. And this is really, really important. That is to say, 80 is not 8 times better than 10, right? You get most of your response at 10 and 20. You get a little bit more at 40 and very little more between 40 and 80. So if you have a patient who comes out of the neuro ICU or the CCU on 80 and they feel miserable, it's fine to move them to 40. You're on the flat part of the curve. Okay, and the biggest bang for your buck is 10, getting people on the drug. You monitor the effect, because again, you're going for a 30 or 50% reduction. But 10 might be just fine for many people, depending on their body size, lipids, and so on. So not everyone needs to be on 80, but pick the right level. And now that rosuvastatin's off patent, it also has the benefit of being in both categories, so also equally easy to use. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on side effects, but it's here for your review. I think the take-home message here is that side effects are very uncommon. Most of the time when the patient comes in with side effects that they think are related to statins, they're not. I had a cramp last night when I was sleeping. It's not statins. My shoulder hurts from pickleball, not statins, and so on. So there's a lot of things that people think could be from statins. It's not from statins, but you have to work with them. And so usually we lower the, you can either stop the medicine for 2 weeks and see what happens. And they don't, if you're lucky, they won't get better and be willing to have that insight and go back on their medicine, or you can lower the dose, or you can switch medicine. Those are all things. But there's good evidence, if you send people who are statin intolerant to a clinic that specializes in treating people with statin intolerance, over 85% of people can tolerate a statin. So there are some people for whom it doesn't work out, and we have other drugs. But most people, even those who are labeled statin intolerant, if you're willing to work with them and explain things, are willing to give it a go. All right, this is my a new question. This is fun. So now I'm going to switch. We've been talking about risk. So the whole thing, and I've been referring to the risk equation. So remember, if the risk is little, no, you can't help much. If the risk is big, you can help a lot. So here's the over the years, we've used this in different equations. Which risk equation do you most commonly use to predict cardiovascular risk in patients? The Framingham equation, the pooled cohort equation, the prevent equation. You don't know the name, but you just put in a dot ASCVD and it shows up on your Epic. I have an app. I don't remember where I got the app, but it works. And, you know, I put it in the app. I prefer to count risk factors to assess risk. I prefer to treat LDL levels without estimating risk. So which of these do you use in your practice? All right. So the majority of you are using dot ASCVD on Epic. And 11% of you are using something called Prevent. And otherwise, there's a bit of a spread, interestingly. All right. So let's talk about this. I'm pleased to tell you that I can teach you something new, and it's really important. So I'm very excited. Okay, so many of you, some of you were using, let me go back one. Whoops. Darn. All right, I don't have the results, never mind. All right, so that's right. So most of you picked the pooled cohort reassessment, even if you didn't know it, because that's the one that's on Epic. So that if you put in dot ASCVD, that's this one. So if you have the app, that's this one. And this has been the one that's been out for about 10 years. It was a little bit better than Framingham, which was the one before that. It was a little bit more precise in the way it defined some of the equations. And the biggest difference was that it included stroke. So Framingham just was coronary artery disease. The pooled equation included stroke. So all of a sudden, everyone's risk got higher. And we all use this. It's on Epic. It's on all the apps. It is the one, as 60% of you said. Has a couple of problems, this one. Number one, we've realized over the last decade or so that race is a social construct and doesn't effectively estimate risk. And so as with renal disease, for example, and calculating creatinine clearance and many other equations in medicine, we've tried to eliminate race as a factor in the equations because of the structural racism implicit in that. So that's been a problem right from the get-go. The other problem is that when you compare this equation with other cohorts and see how well it works, it overestimates risk. And what I mean by that, there's a complicated slide, that's either three different cohorts, but say just look at this one. The equation recommends your risk would be up here, but your actual risk in the equation in the cohort is down here. So it overestimates your risk, and in some cases by a lot. So it's racist and it overestimates risk. Other than that, we use it all the time. So We've been talking to the cardiologist, you know, the head of the Black Cardiology Association happens to be our dean of admission at UCSF, and I've been asking her for years, when are we going to fix this? And she said, it's coming, and it's finally come, and you should all start using this tomorrow, because there is now a better equation, and only 10% of you are using it, so let's do it. So just by way of history, the Framingham equation was presented in 98 and updated a decade later. The problem with Framingham is it was a data set in a small town in Massachusetts, as you know. There were 5,000 individuals in the cohort, and they were mostly white, and they were mostly men. So generalizability, not great. 2013 was the pooled cohort equation, which was definitely a step forward. Combined Framingham with three other cohorts, so we got up to 25,000 patients. It included some racial factors, an expanded age, and it was more precise in the definition of some of the other factors, and it included stroke as an outcome. But we've already discussed that this equation had several flaws, even though we're still using it. The new equation, which you should all be using, is called PREVENT. This was published in 2023. I'm not exactly sure why it's had such a slow uptick, but it's available and we should use it, and it's better. It improves calibration of risk. It removes race from the equation and replaces it with social indicators, which I'll define. It broadens the outcomes to include heart failure. And it expands the risk from 10 years to 30, which is confusing, but it also uses a more of a cardio-renal metabolic framework. And I'll be precise about all this in a minute. So this is there. For some reason, the Heart Association has not yet made an app, at least as far as I know. It is on their website. Luckily, our good friends at MD Calc, which I have no relationship to or anything, and it's free, put it on their app right away. So if you're using MD Calc, PREVENT is on the app, and that's probably the way to go. But it's not on Epic yet. I don't know what Epic's waiting for, but it'll happen one of these days. But use MD Calc in the meantime. It's a diverse sample of over 6 million individuals. As we mentioned, it includes heart failure as well as stroke and heart disease. It includes GFR, albumin-creatinine ratio, BMI, A1C, social determinants. It gives you a 10-year risk. It also does a 30-year risk if you want, although that we're still learning how to use. Here's the key. You can still use it with the current treatment guidelines, and you can still use it with the enhancing risk factors along the lines we've been discussing. So, of note to me is that the experts who wrote this, which is a very esteemed group of cardiologists and nephrologists and epidemiologists and many others, does not include the risk enhancing factors in the equation. So LP little a is not in the equation, right? CT calcium score is not in the equation. CRP is not in the equation, but you can still use them along that continuum as we've discussed before. And here are the factors that are in the equation. I won't read them all, but some of the new ones include body mass index. We'll say more about that later in the week. GFR, again, with a non-race-based equation, whether you're on lipid medications or not. Do you have urine albumin? Again, focusing on the cardio, the renal metabolic aspects of this. How's your A1C? And what is your zip code? Since that is a key feature in some of the social determinants of health. So this is fascinating and available. And part of it includes what's called the social deprivation index. So this is still trying to get at social determinants of health without using a social construct. And it comes from something called the American Community Survey based on zip codes. It's an interesting literature. If you're interested in social determinants, this is a good set of papers to look at. So It provides well-calibrated estimates of risk. It broadens the framework to include heart failure. It eliminates race. It's aligned with the cardio-kidney metabolic framework, provides 10 and 30-year estimates. For now, it's only applicable in the United States because of the ZIP factor issues. The next steps are to evaluate the net benefit in clinical trials and to further implement them in guidelines and in EPIC. So I think I skipped over, but this was really millions and millions of people from big databases that were then validated against the, another cohort. And the risk calculates to be substantially less than the pooled equation. So as you get to know this, what I recommend is to use both, just to see, get some experience with it, and see what you like. But in the data sets, the risk is lower. It still allows you to use your thresholds, whatever you voted for in the first slide, of 7.5%, 10, whatever. But now you have a more accurate assessment of that risk. I'm going to skip over shared decision making for the sake of time, but I still love this website. I've shown it here before over the years, but it's called the Mayo Clinic Statin Choice Decision Aid. It's a lovely set of pictographs where you really can explain to people what you mean. You say your risk is 10%. What does that mean? This case, it was 11%. What it means if you have 11 frowny faces. It means that over 10 years, 89 people aren't going to have a heart attack. And if you treat them for 10 years, over those 10 years, 89 still won't have a heart attack. Eight still will have a heart attack. And your work is you prevented three heart attacks. And so that kind of way of describing risk to patients can be extremely helpful for some. So I, you don't have to remember the name. You just Google Mayo statins or Mayo cholesterol, and it comes right up. In summary, just to go through the drugs real quickly, statins are the treatment of first choice. There's no evidence to support adding niacin or fibric acid. Ezetimibe is a very impotent drug. However, there is one study that shows that it decreases risk, but the risk was 2% absolute risk, 6% relative risk compared to a quarter or a third. And it took 7 years to realize the risk. So I almost never use this drug. There is this study though, and if the cardiologist has started it, it's hard to stop it, but I personally would not have voted for it if I was on the FDA panel, but here it is, and it is approved, and there is evidence to support it, but it's weak. The PCSK9 inhibitors are monoclonal antibodies that reduce LDL liver receptor degradation. They reduce LDL by a ton. This is on top of statins. Most of us in primary care don't use these very much, but the cardiologists do when they can. It's really for the person with severe atherosclerotic disease, so advanced secondary prevention in people who either can't take a statin, those few that can't, or who need to get down even further. They're expensive. The prices come down, but they're still expensive. They're hard to get approved. I don't know if any of you in primary care are using these very much, but they're good drugs. They're just a little disappointing. You know, we thought that if you could get the LDL down to 30, that maybe coronary artery disease would go away. But in fact, the reduction is only 15 or 20% reduction in events. Again, about half of statins. So it does add benefit, and the cardiologists use these for patients with advanced and progressive disease. So you should know about them, and these are fine if your colleagues start them. Another new drug that was just published in the last year or two, bempedoic acid, it works through a different mechanism. Only, you know, again, a modest effect, 13% reduction in events compared to a quarter or a third, but it's another drug that patients who can't tolerate statins can use. Again, most people can tolerate statins if you're patient with them, but this drug is out there as well. And a final drug that's interesting is Vascepa, which is a fish oil derivative, which in patients who meet the criteria, this is again mostly secondary prevention and have persistent high triglycerides despite full dose statins. Again, there's some additional reduction in events. So this is a drug that's underutilized, but may be appropriate for some patients. It is evidence-based for secondary prevention. So this last list of four or five drugs are mostly drugs that cardiologists will use, but there is an evidence base for them and we should be familiar with them. Okay, to summarize, statins are effective and cost-effective in four specific groups of patients. This is easy in primary care when there are only four things, that's good. Use statins in patients who have the disease, any form of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, have a genetic disorder with an LDL that's very high, or have diabetes. Those are the easy ones. Just make sure you're not missing anybody in that cohort. For primary prevention, we can at least frame the discussion by saying if the risk with a new equation is over 20%, treat. Everyone would agree with that. And the reason we agree with that is because 20% is what the risk is. If you've already had an MI, you have about a 20%, 2% a year, 20%, 10-year risk of having another MI. So 20% is a nice number to frame your thinking as a threshold for starting statins. Below that, we're still in an area of nuance because of the continuous relationship. And so calculate the risk using the new PREVENT equation, start on Monday, and treat those that are interested using shared decision making. I think if you use the pictographs, you're going to get more people saying, well, you know, my odds are 89-9. Maybe I don't need it for a little while. And that they're not bad people if they make that decision. I'm very pro-statin, don't get me wrong, but there are some patients who prefer not, and they're not bad people. They just have their own values to deal with this. For patients with 7.5 to 20% risk, risk-enhancing factors may decide. So if the patient's reluctant or you're reluctant, and think of the enhancing risk factors, especially the complicated ones other than family history, think of them as tiebreakers. So if and you can have that discussion with the patient as you're getting the test. And again, in a very high risk, patients consider a second medication in collaboration with your cardiology or neurology specialist. With that, I'll stop and thank you very much for your attention.
Good morning. I have been looking at the PREVENT for a while. I've been using it along with ASCVD, and I was like, when should I use this? Should I use the ASCVD calculator? Should I use the CVD calculator? Because you get to choose one or the other at the bottom. What am I doing with this? I would love to hear more about how I'm supposed to actually use PREVENT to determine who should start a statin.
Yeah, now use it exactly the same way as you would use the pooled equation or the dot ASCVD. All of them give you a number, give you a 10-year risk. And then in that range, the cardiologist would say starting at 7.5, U.S. Preventive Services would say starting at 10, I would say somewhere between 7.5 and 20. Based on that number from either of the equations, that's when you have the discussion and you just have to decide whether you're going to use 7.5 or 10 or a more nuanced approach. But the equation will give you that percent in the same way that the pool equation will. 10-year risk. No, it's use the total risk. Yeah. And that includes heart failure and coronary artery disease and stroke. Yes. Thank you for using the equation.
So many of my partners will just start a cholesterol-lowering medication if the risk is 7.5% or higher. A lot of times what I'll do is I'll play with the, on Epic, you can play with the calculation. So let's say somebody's got 11 to 12% risk and their cholesterol is 220 and their LDL is 135. I'll actually change the numbers down to 180 and LDL down to, you know, 115, just to see what happens if they're normal. And it usually decreases the risk by a minuscule amount, from 12%, let's say, to 11.3%, meaning the vast majority of this risk is from age and not from cholesterol. It's just, and that makes me wonder, like, do you just throw it in the water, give it to every 60-year-old guy?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's where I actually tend to agree with it, more like above 15%. But, you know, people are just kind of like, oh, the number's 10%, let's go for it, or 7.5%. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah. Thank you for that. The equation is not designed to show the efficacy of the drug. So I think it's designed to predict risk, but it doesn't show. So it's two different Venn sets of numbers. So the drugs from the clinical trials reduce your risk by a quarter or a third. And so the equation may not reflect that, but that's what the clinical trials show. And it may be because some of the benefit is coming from non-LDL lowering benefit. So the equations are not designed to answer the question that you're using it for. Clearly, age is the primary driver of risk. There's no question about that. And that was one of the problems with the pooled equation, that if you use the, when they switched from Framingham to the pooled equation, because they added stroke, almost every 60-year-old man was over 7.5%. And so now with PREVENT, you have a little bit more balanced, nuanced equation, and you won't see that as much. And so age is becoming a little bit less predictor of a predictor, because there are other potent factors in the equation, such as cardiometabolic renal factors. So you'll see, as you get more experience with PREVENT, that you'll have less of that age-driven equation. Now, it's different in men and women, you know, because in both equations, younger women, meaning under 60 or under 65, rarely have numbers above 7.5%. And so it's still driven by age and gender to a large extent, but we've now expanded it and created much more nuance with this new equation.
Yeah. So for type 1 diabetics, and we're increasingly seeing type 2 diabetics at the age of 20, what age do you start them on a statin? And also, what's your start cholesterol that you reduce, given the fact that their starting cholesterol is usually pretty good at that early age?
Yeah. You know, when I was in medical school, we heard a lot about the Korean soldiers who died on the battlefield, and at age 18 and at autopsy, they had fatty streaks. And, you know, we've had this idea of heart disease as being a pipe, you know, that you had a fatty streak when you're 18, and every time you ate a piece of butter or an ice cream cone, you know, you got a little more plaque, and then one day you had a big ribeye and, you know, clots off and you have your heart attack. Well, that's just not how it works. You know, that's not how coronary artery disease works. It has to do with plaque instability and plaque rupture and microemboli and so on. That's why stenting doesn't work very well, because we have, you know, feet and feet and feet of coronary artery disease, and we put in an inch of a stent, you know, that's not going to work for, you know, most not saying it doesn't work in all situations, but for stable coronary artery disease, it doesn't work, and that's why it doesn't work. So my bias is I want to give people a statin 10 years or before they're going to have a heart attack. So that's a joke, right, because we have to figure that out. But it's not age 20, and it's not age 35. The American College of Physicians says at least start thinking about it at 35. You know, if people have genetic disorders at 35 or 40, I think, or striking family history, I'm willing to start at the drug. But most of the time, you use the equations and let the equations drive your thinking. And all those people in their 20s, their risk is going to be minuscule, and you can lower it by a quarter or a third, but you're not doing anything And so there's really no evidence to support that 40 years of being on a statin is better than 10. Diabetes, I would think the same way. I know our treatment, you know, our quality assessment guidelines say all diabetics, but the guidelines say age 45 for diabetics. The American Diabetes Association will talk about this on Thursday. They hedge a little bit and say they say 45 to 75, but if you want to start a little earlier in type 2 or you want to start a little earlier, I'll discuss the relationship of diabetes and cardiovascular risk on Thursday.
So, Bobby, a question from online related to that on the other extreme. Age 80, would you start a statin and above, and 75 with diabetes?
Yeah, so diabetes, again, there's no data in either case, or there's no clinical trial data in either case. People over 75 were excluded from the studies, and that's why the guidelines say 45 to 75. And what everyone says then is, but if you want, or the patient wants, and so in my own, and one other observation is that if you were all 80 and above, if you were all 30 and above, and I checked your LDL, I could really predict risk. At 80, cholesterol no longer is a risk factor of predicting risk because age drives the outcome. So observational evidence would suggest there's no benefit of treating cholesterol over age 80. So I often will joke with patients and say, happy birthday at 75 or say, or 80 or whatever. Say, I really want you to continue to take your blood pressure medicine, and we're really happy that you're on your GLP and that you're exercising and so on. But if you want, you can stop your statin. And I've never had anyone say yes. You know, why would I stop? I'm doing great. You know, thank you, Dr. Barrow, I'm fine. So I think in clinical practice, there's not much evidence for starting it, but clinical practices, if you've already started and people are on it and tolerating it, to continue. On the other hand, if people have symptomatic coronary artery disease or clinical coronary artery disease, the recommendations are continue it throughout the lifespan until you hit hospice type, you know, you can stop it during hospice and there's no adverse outcomes. But generally for secondary prevention, we treat throughout the lifespan.
Of quite a few questions, we'll come back to you in a second, about your views on the statin you choose, atorvastatin versus the others, and when would you choose one versus the other?
So I prefer rosuvastatin and atorvastatin. I usually use atorvastatin first because it was on generic first. I like them both because they're both in the moderate and the high category, and you can start low and go slow, but get into the high intensity with both. The moderate intensity statins are fine if that's your goal. So you can keep, if people are on pravastatin still or simvastatin and they've been fine for lovastatin, even if they're fine and their lipids are at goal, there's no need to switch them. But if people aren't quite at goal, you know, they're on lovastatin, I don't know, 40 and the LDL's 104 or something, you know, at some point you might just switch them to a high potency, to a more potent drug. The most important point is, point is that simvastatin 80 is not recommended. There's a little bit more muscle disease, so that's sort of fallen out of favor. But you can use simvastatin 20 or 40. But since rosuvastatin and atorvastatin are generic and have the whole range, I think they're sort of more commonly used, and that's been my practice.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.